Hello, everyone. It's nice to be here tonight for another talk. I'm adjusting my screen since I'm not used to this. I just saw a little thing float by, but can everyone hear me okay? Yes? Okay, great. Well, I hope the practice period continues to go well for everyone who's in it. And it's been a great joy for my practice period to think more deeply about the Dharma and work on these talks. So thank you for showing up tonight and listening. Maybe you didn't know I was speaking. Even better. What a surprise. So tonight, I thought I would talk to you a little bit about my experience of the feeling of our practice. This is something that Suzuki Roshi is bringing up a lot in this book. And I wanted to think about the feeling of our practice and what gets in the way. So from the first chapter of the book on page 12, Suzuki Roshi says, "Because we have so much useless rubbish in our minds, it's hard to share our feelings with people, with things, with trees, or with mountains. Even though we are right in the middle of the woods, it is hard to appreciate the feeling of the woods. When we can really appreciate the feeling of the woods, that is Zazen." What is this useless rubbish in our minds that Suzuki Roshi is referring to? Sometimes it's our own self-centered, sticky thoughts and emotions that take us out of the present moment. We also know that language itself can be the thing that gets in the way. And Norman has talked about this before, that language kind of swings both ways. It's sort of like the self. We can consider language to be a tool. We need it sometimes, and sometimes we need to learn how to put language down. As we become our true selves, I think we begin to appreciate the power of silence and the limitation of language more and more. Often language can get in the way of feeling, and feeling is an important part of our practice. As Suzuki Roshi says, really appreciating the feeling of the woods, the birds, or another person. I'm reminded of the limitation of language at least once a week because Richard and I are still trying to learn Italian, and we show up for a one-hour conversation in Italian with our instructor, Valentina. And we've been studying with her for several years now. My notebooks are filled with vocabulary words that kind of limb the edge of our conversation each week. These are the words that I wanted to remember, but I couldn't at the time. And they rest on the page like fallen leaves from the tree of our conversation. The lists contain only parts, not the whole of what I feel or want to express, not the whole of what Valentina is trying to convey to us. Here's an example from my notebook from January 26 of this year, where I wrote the phrase, dare alla luce, which means to give light. It also means to give birth. And then spegnersi, to fade, to dim, to pass away. We used to meet in person with Valentina, but now we have our Italian conversations on Zoom. And over the years, we've experienced a lot together, the three of us, from the COVID pandemic, to a cancer diagnosis, to family divorces and marriages, and concerns for the well-being of immigrants like herself. As I look back over these weekly pages of words, I remember what I was struggling to say, the deep feeling I was hoping to convey, but the language kept getting in the way. And of course, even a native language can get in the way of appreciating the feeling of the woods. We live in such a language-heavy culture, and that's why it's good to be reminded by Suzuki Roshi to put our reliance on language down for a while and just appreciate the deep feeling of this moment. We need to allow other ways of knowing and other ways of understanding to enter us. And Asvaghosha also points to the limitation of language when he says, this is on page 33, all explanations by words are provisional and without validity, for they are merely used in accordance with illusions and are incapable of denoting suchness. The term suchness is, so to speak, the limit of verbalization, wherein a word is used to put an end to words. But the essence of suchness itself cannot be put an end to. And later he says, it should be understood that all things are incapable of being verbally explained or thought of, hence the name suchness. It should be understood that all things are incapable of being verbally explained or thought of, hence the name suchness. No wonder silence is a highly valued form in Zen practice. So much deep feeling was conveyed when the Buddha held up a flower and Mahakashapa smiled. No words needed for this complete transmission of the Dharma, this insight into suchness. In my own experience, I try to appreciate the way my own consciousness is sort of a team effort involving all of my senses, not just my facility for language. Our experience gets wobbly and one-sided when we let language do all the talking, so to speak. Sometimes it's much better to just sit and breathe before responding. And as Suzuki Roshi says on page 56, if your mind is disturbed, your breathing will be disturbed too. Because breathing is both a mental and a physical activity. Taking care of breathing is the way to take care of yourself. Anyone who has sat at the bedside of an ill friend or a relative knows the limits of language. When I served as a volunteer at the hospice at Laguna Honda Hospital, I often visited with an elderly Vietnamese-American woman named An. And she spoke no English, and I spoke no Vietnamese. And in her early stage dementia, she longed to be visited and taken home by her family. She seemed certain every day that someone, one of the family members, would come by, but that was not the case. On Tuesday afternoons, when I visited with her, she was often in a deep state of sadness. All I could do was hold her hand and sit next to her while she cried. Sometimes silently, sometimes with great sobbing. I was learning to appreciate the deep feeling of her presence in that little room. But I have to admit, it was not easy for me. I'm a crier, or at least I was a crier, and I sometimes worried in those situations that I would get lost in my tears. And that was the problem. My tears, not the feeling of Anne's sadness, but my thoughts and emotions about Anne's sadness. It's a subtle but important distinction that I was learning to make. And as we learn from Suzuki Roshi later in this text, as Norman has talked about, don't put a head on top of your head. There was already sadness in Anne's room, and that was enough. I didn't need to go overboard and intensify or affix the situation. So I think Suzuki Roshi is pointing us toward a subtle state of being, a place somewhere between explaining the feeling away with language on the one hand and inflating a feeling with our own sticky emotional stories on the other hand. It cuts to the heart of our practice of being with suffering, compassion. It's what we aspire to when we chant the first line of the Enmei Juku Kanangyo. As Mel Weitzman explains, Kan means to penetrate. Ze is the world. An is sound. Kan ze an, to penetrate the sounds of the world, or to hear them, to hear the suffering sounds of the world. It also implies the mind of vow. Kan ze an vow is to attend to the suffering cries of the world. In these situations in hospice over the years, and in my own life, I've tried to show up more like a bodhisattva, with feeling, but not with overwhelm. Perhaps with a tear or two, but also with steadiness and love. I guess that's why breathing is so important. Weeping all the time would be exhausting. Believe me, I've tried it. But we can and we must breathe all the time. And that is why I and so many others have learned to do, that's what we've learned to do at hospice and with hospice training. Deep gratitude to Frank and Martha and all the others who've helped train many volunteers over the years with the simple call to sit, breathe, and listen first, and then respond. When we take time to appreciate that deep feeling of the woods, as Suzuki Roshi says, we have access to a wider array of responses. When we can really appreciate the feeling of the woods, that is Zazen. When I first read this quote, when Norman and I were looking at the text, I was so happy. Like so many of us, experiences in nature are central to my understanding of the Dharma. If Zazen emerges in the woods, then sign me up. From early childhood, time spent in the woods and in the mountains, really, has always pointed me toward a more expansive sense of self and mind. And when I'm in nature, I often feel the perfection that Suzuki Roshi talks about in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And in that book, he has a great quote, "The reason everything looks beautiful is because it is out of balance, but its background is always in perfect harmony. This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature, losing its balance against a background of perfect balance." And I think he's describing the beauty of impermanence here, set against the dynamic flow of change. But it can be difficult to stay open all the time and to appreciate or trust the feeling and perfection of a place or a situation. There can be a lot going on inside of our heads. One night I was sitting outside in Point Reyes on the edge of a large wetland there, the Giacomini Marsh, that some of you are familiar with. It was about 9 p.m. at night, and the rain had just finished pounding the landscape. And in the silence that followed before the ducks started quacking in the dark, the coyote bush right next to me began to rustle with activity. I was worried that it might be a skunk plodding along the edge of the marsh, as they often do in the middle of the night. And when he emerged, I thought for sure he'd be startled by my presence, and then who knows what would happen next. But before I could worry too much about that scenario, a gray fox emerged from the bushes. And apparently, he had decided it was time to enjoy the dry break between storms. I stayed perfectly still and watched with amazement as his shadowy form moved closer and closer and closer to me. And then he leaned in to sniff the tip of my rubber boot. A perfect moment of appreciating the deep feeling of fox and night and curiosity. But I have to admit, I was a little nervous. What if he bites my boot? He's a predator, after all. Fortunately, the smallest flick of my ankle was enough to make him spring back a bit. But the night was too beautiful, and I was sitting super still. So rather than fleeing, the fox sat back on his haunches and stayed next to me. Me and the fox and the night and the wet grass began to shift into just being. The whole thing may have lasted, I don't know, 60 seconds before he wandered off, but it was a moment that seemed to stretch for eternity. A blessing of overcoming fear and appreciating the deep feeling of the moment. I mention this not to suggest that my experience is in any way unique, but rather to reinforce your own capacity to sit and appreciate the feeling of being alive with other beings. Another thing that struck me in this first chapter by Suzuki Roshi is his metaphor of opening a tin can. And he says on page 13, "The purpose of our practice is to open up our mind. You must open it up like you open a tin can. You must cut hard and open the tin so that you can eat what's inside. But just to open is not enough. The spirit of repetition is also necessary. That's why Zazen and Sangha and Dharma friends are so important. They help us keep the spirit of repetition going. And we really need that. We really need to keep prying open the tin can of our self-centered view. Later in that chapter, Suzuki Roshi goes on to say that if you don't have this kind of spirit of repetition, you cannot cope with the problems you have day after day. As long as you live, you eat something, he says. After you eat, you may have a big rubbish pile of cans and wrappers. So you should continuously work on it. You should clear your table every day, even if you feel that you are clearing everything from your table. It must be done with the spirit of continuing to do so forever. In other words, unlike language, there is no punctuation to our practice, no period at the end that signals the completion of our achievement in thought or in action. Instead, we have the ongoingness of night turning into day and day turning into night. We wake with our intention to open the can of our mind and to clear away the rubbish of extra thoughts and worries, to appreciate the feeling of being alive in the world with others. Juryu states in the introduction to our text, being yourself is not a concept to master or a state to achieve. It's an ongoing, embodied practice in the middle of our ordinary life. We need Suzuki Roshi's spirit of repetition because the isolated self has its own patterns and energy of repetition. The small self is constantly trying to be more than it is, constantly insisting on its primacy. So we counter it with a different kind of repetition. The repetition of Dharma practice, Zazen on the cushion, and deep awareness and compassionate action off the cushion. And when we're off the cushion, so to speak, it's helpful to have a few techniques, some aids to remind us of our practice. I sometimes use what poet Alison Luderman describes as sky before screens. And I use this before or after Zazen in the morning, or before I have a difficult phone call. Before touching a screen and opening a portal to a world of language and problems and drama and intrigue, I take time to look at the sky. Sometimes it's only a glance out the window. Other times I stand out on the balcony with our cat and really look at the wider view, the way the clouds are moving, the various tints of blue or gray. Of course, daily Zazen does this too, but this is a reminder on top of my Zazen practice to keep my thoughts in perspective, to remember the wider field of awareness. When I talk to my folks on the phone or when I visit my parents at home, I try my best to remember what An taught me in that little room in hospice and what Suzuki Roshi is trying to tell us now. To be aware of what is happening, to appreciate the feeling of the moment, and to respond from that place. He tells us on page 50, we know how we can help others only when we know how we should exist. For this reason, we must extend Zazen practice to our everyday life. Having the right practice in everyday life, we can help others in a true sense. A few months ago, after several years of speaking only in Italian on Monday nights, our Italian instructor, Valentina, asked Richard and me if we would be willing to speak in English for an hour on a different day. We met on a Saturday morning on Zoom to talk about the political situation and to discuss her fears and worries about being deported, but really to help her hold the feeling of her anxiety. It was a mutual recognition that over the years, the depth of our feeling for each other had grown beyond our capacity to express it in Italian, one of the most expressive languages in the world. At first, I was a little disappointed in myself. I had to let go of my ambition to be a fluent Italian speaker. I had to let go of the false identity that I might be someone who could convey my whole emotional life in Italian words and phrases. But then I realized in making this switch to an hour of deeply needed English conversation, I became someone better than a fluent Italian speaker. I became someone who could hear the suffering in our teacher's voice and could respond in whatever language was called for, whether that language is English, or silence, or touch, or tears. Our practice of appreciating the feeling of the woods, of a room, of a situation, helps us to respond with sensitivity and clarity. Through all their writings, Asfaghosha and Suzuki Roshi are pointing us to this underlying wholeness or suchness and giving us guidance on how to get closer to it, to trust it, to appreciate the feeling of the woods. I've been talking about the limits of language tonight, but only because we use it so often. In the end, though, language and silence are just fingers pointing at the moon of our original enlightenment. They are forms and tools we employ to release our self-centered view and open up our experience of this moment and the wondrous possibility of our true nature. So thank you again for listening to me. I think I spoke very quickly because we have a lot of time. And as we usually do, I'm going to, I'm going to let people jump off who do not want to be in a small group. And I had thought that maybe having a little homework might be nice on this talk. So if you're still on, one thing to think about this week, which really fits into the category of wise speech, is to try and catch yourself before speaking or using language this week. Ask yourself, is what I'm about to say necessary? Am I ready to respond? And what other ways of knowing or responding might be available to me? So just something to consider for this week. So we're almost to the hour. I'm thinking, we can break into small groups and maybe we should do 5 minutes. I'm not sure who's hosting tonight.
I am. It's Leni Tracy.
Oh, hi, Leni. Hi. Thanks. So I think we have enough time. Let's give each person in groups of three 5 minutes and then another 5 minutes just to check in. So that'll be 20 minutes. And then we can reconvene here and see what comments come up.